Tuesday night edition of the Dunktown Basketball Podcast. Got a lot of news to get to since we haven't updated in a little bit, and then a little talk about tonight's games as well. Danny, what's up?
Ready to talk about some season-ending injuries.
Well, let's actually go to something a little bit more interesting than that first. Stephen A. Smith reporting, and not in an article or anything, but just in a radio appearance, I think, that according to his sources close to LeBron, the Cavs should by no means assume that LeBron will just come back this year in free agency, and that they better keep him happy and they can't put everything on his shoulders the way they did last time. What do you think of that?
The PR just nightmare that would come to him if he left again, especially considering their team is the best team in the Eastern Conference, is hard to comprehend. Like, where would he go?
Yeah, that's a good point. Where, not Golden State.
Not the Spurs.
Like, I think they actually would be worse if they got him. Actually, Golden State would be. Hey, maybe the Wizards could get him.
They have all that space cleared.
Yeah, that's true. I think you're right about that, that they're really this, aside from the fact that they kind of pulled this last year, and I think they leaked it to Chris Haynes last year, and this year it's Stephen A., and there's really, I just really don't see the point of this other than just as a little reminder, hey, you need to do what I want or keep paying or stay in line or whatever. But as far as just the amount of money that they have paid and the moves that they have made, everything that they've done has been incredibly win now focused. They haven't made a single move, I don't think, that, you know, was tax avoidance the way you'll see some teams do that also hurt them on the floor. I mean, they traded Varejao for Channing Frye. I think that's pretty clearly an upgrade. So, you know, this was on the heels of a report by Chris Haynes that the Cavs leaders were outraged that Kendrick Perkins, their big enforcer, they moved on from him and signed Sasha Khan instead, who's kind of a David Black guy from Russia and who hasn't played at all. I mean, not that Perkins really helped them. Maybe you could say that because Varejao was one of LeBron's guys, you know, obviously it was a huge mistake to sign into that contract extension. Once more showing kind of the folly of listening to players, at least in their explicit demands. So maybe that went into all this as well, but I agree with you. Where would he go is the ultimate question.
It's kind of an non-starter, and the idea of them having an enforcer, look at how many big men they have. A guy like that wouldn't play. So what, you know, do you want to have a late career Charles Oakley type guy who's just a voice on that team? They don't have any rookies they need to keep in line. This is a team full of vets. I don't really understand. I get the sentimentality of it, but it's a little bit ridiculous.
Well, someone on the team, I can't remember who, I think, as I recall, it was a couple days ago, so I'm going from memory here, was quoted in Chris's story saying essentially, hey, look what happened in that game 4 against Boston when after Olynyk ended Kevin Love's season, we brought in Kendrick Perkins and, you know, he sure made sure that the tenor of the game changed or something. I mean, it's just completely antiquated, ridiculous thinking. And, you know, if these players think that Kendrick Perkins is somehow the reason why they, you know, are not in the same league as San Antonio or Golden State, they've probably got another thing coming, I would say.
Yeah, I would agree.
Yeah, I mean, that if we hear more of this, I think we can get in more to, all right, where could LeBron really go, you know? But, I mean, I guess you could say that he and KD could team up with the Lakers. You know, that's the other thing. But, yeah, let's get to KD. Also, some interesting reports about him, again, from a somewhat non-traditional non-written source. Joel Myers, the former Lakers play-by-play guy, now play-by-play guy for the Pelicans, one of the most mellifluous voices in the league, and he used that voice to say that he made a bunch of calls and that his understanding is that Durant is out of Oklahoma City if they make the finals. If they don't make the finals, sorry.
Yeah, which would be kind of an amazing ultimatum, and Durant has denied it, which isn't surprising because whether it was true or it isn't, he has to deny it. It's kind of like the Demo thing where you have to say that because it puts too much pressure on their organization. But what I've wondered about for a long time with Durant, and it's, you know, part of what I've always been thinking with the idea that was behind the Warrior stuff that I've done, is just he has to be thinking to a point about his legacy and just sitting there going, well, if he hits his mid-30s or his early-30s even and he hasn't won a title yet, you know, what does that do? He would, like, if he ends his career without a championship, I would say he's the greatest player in NBA history who doesn't have one.
Yeah, that's true. I think he's well on pace to be a top 20 player of all time. I mean, I think in ESPN's NBA rank, he was, you know, 22nd or something like that already. And so I think he certainly could even, if he wins a championship or two, could even conceivably get into the top 10 all time. And, you know, if he doesn't win a championship, it's going to be much harder to do that. The other component of the report was that he supposedly wants to be the man, which would mean, you know, he's not going to Golden State. But again, you have that same question, one that I have harped on for a very long time in these Durant discussions, when I said back even at the start of the year that I thought there was a 75% chance he would stay in Oklahoma City, which is, where else is he going to go that is a better situation for him? And maybe I discounted the possibility that Westbrook could leave there too, you know, and that maybe if he doesn't get more of a commitment from him, that then he might consider moving on because he doesn't know if Westbrook is going to be there. But I still think, you know, certainly for next year, it is hard to say anywhere that would give him a better shot than Oklahoma City unless he wants to just glom on in Golden State.
Yeah, that's what I was getting at with the piece I wrote for the Sporting News last week about how, for me, if he's going to sign a 1+1, which I think, unless he's going to go to a place like Golden State, you know, a place they can't sign him in a year, he would do for financial reasons, for logistical reasons. Oklahoma City's the perfect place for it because it's his best chance of winning a championship on a one-off team, and he gets the certainty of knowing what happens with those guys and the PR kind of benefit of letting one of them go first if that's what's going to happen. And, you know, like letting Russ, I don't think if Westbrook wants to leave, he would have too many qualms about being the first one to leave off of that team. So I think that's the most likely path for a lot of different reasons, unless, of course, he wants to go somewhere that wouldn't have the space, and that would be presumably the Warriors or possibly the Wizards, though Beal's contract is making that a little bit possible, maybe in 2017.
So, yeah, you mentioned Beal. He, I think, in his first game back in the starting lineup, fell after a hard drive, got knocked to the floor. He is diagnosed with a sprained pelvis, not on the road trip with Washington, which began today with an overtime loss in Portland, which we'll talk about later. Lance Stephenson missed about a month with that injury last year. I think that's the only other one that shows up in Jeff Stotts' injury database. So we don't know how long it's going to be for him, but for a Wizards team where Beal was just starting to get rolling, where his, you know, this minutes limit was at least going to be relaxed with him being in the starting lineup, another just severe, severe setback. And, you know, they almost certainly would have won this Blazers game today had he been in the lineup.
There was a little report out there that they were hopeful he could be back for Friday's game, but that seems too early based on the limited precedent we have. But you never know. With something like this, maybe it's a little bit less severe than what happened to Lance. But, you know, with Beal, my operating thing is always I'll treat him as being active when I see him play.
Yeah, and the other thing, too, is for a guy who has had these overuse injuries, these constant stress reactions in his shin. Now, if you have a sprained pelvis, that's something that I would imagine is really going to kind of mess up your gait and could potentially lead to more of those injuries as well. Next one, Eric Gordon came back from his fractured right ring finger. He is now out for the season with a fractured right ring finger.
Yeah, Mason Ginsburg noted that the URL of the announcement of his injury, it was the normal stuff, and then Eric Gordon injury 3, because they had already used probably injury 1 and 2. So it's sad. I didn't mean to laugh to make light of it. It's just kind of ridiculous that the point that the Pelicans are in terms of their health, because they also lost Bryce DeJean-Jones, who they recently signed for on a rest of the year contract, and then now he's out for the rest of the year with a fractured wrist.
Controversial opinion. I think it is much better for the Pelicans in a number of facets that he actually re-injured himself and is out for the year again. Do you agree with that?
Well, for the same reasons that we thought they should trade him, it's pretty much along the same lines, and it limits his value, which makes it theoretically more likely he would come back on a discount. So, yeah, if you're callous and cold-hearted, sure.
Yeah, I mean, this is a team that needs to dismiss this fiction about potentially contending. You know, they beat Sacramento last night in a game where DeMarcus Cousins had 41 points. You know, I mean, that, and they've actually been pretty good at home lately. And then also, as you noted, anything that holds down Gordon's potential value on the market with him now basically will have missed the entire second half of the season, not necessarily with an injury that you'd expect to be permanent, but, you know, if he doesn't have that track record for the last 40 games of the season, that's something that will depress his value. And if they hope to bring him back, could potentially be a boon. Although I still would be surprised if he came back there. I think they would really have to go over the moon with any kind of offer to get him back, considering how desperate he was to get out of there 4 years ago.
Yeah. Do you want to, Michael Carter Williams, you want to go on there?
Yeah.
So Michael Carter Williams, reported by Mark Spears of Yahoo, he underwent season, or did it already happen, or is it going to happen? I'm not completely sure. Either
I don't know, but yeah, but he a torn labrum in his left hip, an injury and a surgery that we are seeing more and more often these days, I would imagine just due to better surgical techniques and better diagnosis rather than the fact that people weren't having this injury before. But this is another one. He, good and bad perhaps for the Bucks, he is going into his fourth year after this. He'll be extension eligible. But he also was starting to show a few strides in terms of his jump shot. On the other hand, they have been basically going with point Giannis, and he's been racking up triple doubles. He's developed this great chemistry with Jabari Parker, who's running the baseline and scoring a bunch. And I think maybe Zach Lowe noted this in his column today, that despite the Bucks having a disappointing season overall, they probably have to be pretty pleased with what Giannis and Jabari have been able to do. And if you're really going to put the franchise now in the hands of Giannis, that you have to get someone who is a better fit than Michael Carter Williams at point guard, and maybe this will be a gentle impetus in that direction for them.
They also have a logical two guard for that combination in Chris Middleton. So they're, you know, you need the ends, which are incredibly important. But if Giannis can handle more of the usage, more of the playmaking, you can go a little bit different at point guard there. And I'm hopeful that they can make it work. And I actually really like Carter Williams against backups. I think his combination of size and work ethic, I think he's the type of guy that can really make opposing backup one, sweat and work hard and make it.
Yeah, because those guys are usually kind of shorter guys. I mean, the quintessential example is what he did to Aaron Brooks in the playoffs last year for the Bulls.
Right, that's exactly what I was thinking of. And so he can do that, and also you can, you know, build a little bit around that. And if they're going to keep Greg Monroe, who knows if they'll do that, you can even do something with the two of them together, and you can then do something, have a defensive five, let's say, with the starting lineup. And they're really good players, and this is a team that has cap space. So I'm actually, something I've been really impressed with this year, and Milwaukee deserves a lot of credit for this, is teams that used assets last year on players that it didn't work out perfectly, Monroe, Michael Carter-Williams, and Enes Kanter are all probably guys like this, that they're not necessarily starting them. They don't feel the pressure to do that, and their goal is to just build their team out as best they can, and that is really hard to do.
Yeah, and it could be that the Bucks kind of end up being lucky because they still have this core of Giannis and Jabari, and those guys are still insanely young. I think they're both 20. Maybe Giannis, his birthday is in December, so maybe he just turned 21. But in any event, those two guys are young enough where even if they do sort of have this interlude where they have Monroe, his contract expires after next season, so does Carter Williams. Granted, they gave up Brandon Knight to get Carter Williams.
Or the Lakers pick, alternatively.
Yeah. So I think that we may just see this as sort of like a brief start and stop for this Bucks team, and they'll continue to build with their draft pick this year and with more youth around those guys. But they have the luxury of plenty of time, and unlike Phoenix, who really never actually got those two foundational players that were young the way the Bucks did. I mean, because Phoenix and the Bucks are kind of analogous in that they took an unexpected step forward in a year. But the problem for Phoenix is the only top pick they got was Alex Len, and he's probably, you know, had some good games recently, but not someone you look at as a foundational player.
And Toronto is probably the other team like that, but Toronto had stronger underlying factors. Kyle Lowry is now a superstar, so they were able to do it in kind of a different way.
Yeah, one of the things too that Woj had reported, and he's always kind of never seemed to have much of an opinion of Jason Kidd in the agenda of his reporting, but he reported supposedly that Kidd wanted them to make some moves at the trade deadline and that those were actually vetoed by management. And I would have to say, actually, that if sort of these foibles over the last couple of years, because there have always been whispers that Kidd is really the guy in charge and he wants to eventually move upstairs into a general manager role. I don't think he's qualified for that, frankly. And, you know, if the Carter Williams trade is one of the things that he was a big mind behind, I don't think that ever really made a ton of sense for them. So I think if this ends up in Kidd not getting power in the organization, that's probably for the best as well.
Plus, I think he's done a good job coaching on the aggregate, both in Brooklyn and there. And if he's going to transition, I think that's taking him away from what he does better.
What else we got?
Sonny Weems. This is actually a notable thing, I think, that for a couple different reasons.
Is that why we are going to note it? I guess so.
Yeah, so what happened is, in order to clear a roster spot for Chase Budinger in one of the brilliant foresight moves of the year so far, the Phoenix Suns justifiably waived Sonny Weems, who signed for 2 years, I believe was for the room mid-level.
Right, yeah, he was non-guaranteed for next year.
Right, so he's non-guaranteed for next year, and as had been speculated with Benno and a couple other guys, the Sixers claimed Sonny Weems and waived Christian Wood, to my chagrin. And now that got them over the salary floor, and since he's non-guaranteed for next year, they get to take a roll of the dice on him.
Yeah, I think he's someone, granted he's 30, but still someone who maybe could help them at least as a guy who is an experienced basketball player, even though it's overseas, if not in the U.S. and the Sixers don't have enough of those, still has some athleticism, has been able to shoot the ball decently at times in Europe. So I think type of guy I would certainly take a look at if I'm them, especially if it saves me millions of dollars, as this will. So there was some speculation that maybe the Sixers would just give that money to their players, distribute it as you have to for not reaching the salary floor. But the combination of maybe potentially getting a useful guy, we'll see if he actually ever plays for them, or perhaps more importantly, saving that money was enough to go in that direction.
Other transactional news, the Pacers officially signed Ty Lawson. That was something that we had talked about before. I do not know yet whether he got the minimum prorated or the prorated room exception, which is more a financial thing because it's not like the Pacers are a tax team or anything.
Yeah, and then he immediately sprained his foot in that really nice victory that they had against the Spurs last night, so I haven't heard a report yet on how long he'll be out for. Another one, Anthony Brown, who the Lakers took with the 34th pick in this last draft, reputed to be a 3-and-D guy out of Stanford, had actually been getting the starts when Kobe Bryant hadn't been around, more out of default, the two most wonderful words in the English language, than any other reason, because the other options were Nick Young and Meta World Peace. Hadn't really been able to shoot that well, but again, the fact that he is now out for, I think, a month, but probably effectively the rest of the year with a stress reaction in his foot is kind of too bad, and now it means I think we're going to see a lot of that Nick Young Meta World Peace combination at the three for the Lakers.
Also, the Nets named former Dukie Trajan Langdon their assistant general manager. He was the director of player administration and basketball operations for the Cavs before this.
Yeah, and he was also in the Spurs organization for a few years after a nice long career in Europe. He was obviously, of course, on that Duke 99 national runner-up, but probably one of the best college teams to never win a championship, actually, in my opinion, back when I actually used to care about college basketball. More troubling injury news. Jimmy Butler returned, played a great, great game against the Rockets on Saturday as the Bulls won, and then immediately had his knee swell up. He played 21 of the first 24 minutes and 34 in total, was not on a minutes limit, and the only reason he only played 34 was because he had some foul trouble and it ended up fouling out in that game. The swelling supposedly gone down, supposedly nothing structurally wrong. He's not getting an MRI. Fred Hoiberg defended the decision, saying he'd been working out for 2 weeks and not put him on a minutes limit, but maybe they should have put him on a minutes limit.
Always recommend being cautious, especially when him going out again cost them a playoff berth.
Well, and for all the carping about Tom Thibodeau, the Bulls have definitely had quite a few injury foibles, maybe not as many as in the past. I mean, you know, a lot of the hashtag Fred cleared him was, of course, a funny thing on Bulls Twitter for a while. Fred Tedeschi, they moved on from him. They have Jen Swanson now, who had worked with Derrick Rose as kind of the director of athletic performance. The front office put minutes limits on Noah and Rose last year, and Butler really was the only one who was playing a ton of minutes last year. But yet, despite these changes, despite Thibodeau not being around there anymore, you still sort of see the organization having a few of these problems. It's playing Rose a ton of minutes too, when he always seems to break down with these little kind of injury maladies. So I think despite all the changes, they haven't quite figured it out yet there in Chicago.
One other small thing, Draymond Green was actually questionable before yesterday's game against Orlando, and found out, I didn't find out until after the game, that it's because he has strep throat. So we'll have to see if that affects him. You know, this is a stretch for the Warriors where they have, I think they have 5 more home games in a week and a half. So if they can, you know, go through that, I think they say he's going to be on antibiotics for 2 weeks. So he's such an important part of that team. We'll see if it lingers.
Yeah, and he's been awful in his last 2 games, I would imagine, due to that illness. All right, you want to get to some games for today?
Let's do it. You want to start with Raptors Nets, or do you want to go late game first?
Let's go late game first, because we might get some people tuning out on Raptors Nets. So that was actually, I thought it was a pretty good game, and the Nets have been playing better of late. But Wizards Blazers was an awesome game, I thought. The Wizards played really well to be in it. Dame Lillard had another 40-point game. Really enjoyed it. What are your sort of 30,000-foot takeaways from this one?
It was disappointing how Washington couldn't take advantage of Markieff Morris being guarded by Damian Lillard after a switch, because that's kind of why you have Markieff Morris and you have a bigger four who's a talented guy, is that you can take advantage of that. And ideally, John Wall would be able to do something against Ed Davis. And I think for the most part, it wasn't so much that the shots didn't go in, it was that the shots, when they even got shots, weren't that good of looks.
Yeah. So down the end of the game, I think maybe about 4 minutes left, Washington ran a 1-4 pick and roll. Markieff got a wide open jumper, you know, about a 19-footer from the top of the key. And after that, Terry Stotts decided that he was going to switch that with Ed Davis and Dame Lillard. And so the results basically were John Wall missing a couple of long jumpers, not great shots on Ed Davis. And then they entered the ball into Markieff 3 times. He took 2 terrible fadeaways, neither of which was particularly close to going in, and committed a charging foul on Lillard, which was actually, I thought, a pretty good call. He really, like, you know, lowered his shoulder right into his face, essentially. Very disturbing. I think other than one good game, the Markieff acquisition has not particularly been working out. I think that Jared Dudley, despite some of his athletic limitations, especially on the defensive glass, probably does a better job for them, frankly, at the four, though they had to play him at the 3 down the end of this game just due to their lack of wings and Allen Anderson getting thrown out of the game. But yeah, it's just Markieff is supposed to be able to post up, and he wasn't able to successfully kind of put Dame in the goal. It was just the same kind of fadeaways that he always seems to take. Hasn't been hitting his threes incredibly well either. So yeah, that was discouraging, even though I thought the Wizards overall played reasonably well on offense, but that was mostly due to perhaps an uncharacteristic performance from their bench, like Roman Sessions.
Yeah, Sessions played well, and he closed the game for a reason. He was their second-best guard, and so he was on the floor for, I think, the end of regulation and overtime. And, you know, he ended up with 21 points on 12 field goal attempts. He had 5 assists and only 2 turnovers, and he just played well. I mean, you can talk about the statistics, but he wasn't making many mistakes out there. He was creating shots for himself and others, and you're going to need that. And something that I always think about with the Wizards is that they're usually a disaster when John Wall's off the floor, and they weren't as much tonight.
Yeah, Wall actually had the worst plus-minus on the team at negative 30. He had 20 points, but it took him 27 shooting possessions to do it. He was only 1 out of 4. The Wizards in total, 11 out of 23 from the free throw line, which was pretty miserable. I guess I said I thought that they're lucky to be in it, and they were, in the sense that they got some real good performances from guys like Dudley and Sessions, but they also were just so broke from the free throw line. It wasn't even really bad free throw shooters who were particularly missing either. You know, it was Nene, Sessions was only 2 out of 5. Wall was 1 out of 4. Kelly Oubre went 0 for 2. So that was really disappointing for them. I think in that respect, maybe you can say that they probably should have won this game. But, you know, it didn't work out that way. And the big reason it didn't is because Dame just had another ridiculous game. And I think that he is kind of starting to get closer to that Steph Curry kind of shot selection. He got up 13 threes in this game, took quite a few kind of in transition shots that really no one else in the league other than Steph takes. He's not as good at them as Steph is. But when you're behind the 3-point line, I mean, he still shot 6 out of 13 on threes, despite taking some pretty ugly shots. When you're behind the 3-point line, you know, if you make even 33% of those, you're being efficient.
He also had some big finishes, particularly the one that basically sealed the game, which put them up 4 in the overtime, and which is another thing that Stephen Curry has gotten a lot better at over the course of his career.
Yeah, we've seen that. Dame was 5 of 7 at the rim, 6 of 13 on threes, so that means that he took 20 of his 25 shots either at the rim or from 3. That is just an excellent, excellent ratio, and I think he took only 2 twos outside of the paint in the whole game, and he also got to the line and was 11 to 12 at the line too. Some of those were in, as the Wizards were trying to catch up at the very end. And he had 11 assists. So, yeah, pretty good game. he definitely outplayed John Wall, in making his case for being, I don't know, the fifth best point guard in the NBA, maybe, if Kyle Lowry is number 4.
Yeah. The top 2 all NBA teams are basically spoken for with the top 4 point guards in the league. And then he'll have a chance with that. But something that struck me early in this game, and of course it's not their, you know, go-to lineup. They actually closed with something different. But it's hard to exactly pinpoint it, but I don't feel like the Aminu, Noah Vonleh, Mason Plumlee front court should work, quote-unquote, just because they don't have a lot of spacing. They don't really have natural rim protection. And I personally prefer the Davis-Leonard combination, which actually closed the game. But when you get so much offense and so much shot creation from Lillard and McCollum, you can make that work.
Yeah, you can make it work, although I would note that the way that they're using Vonleh is a little suspect in just and I understand why they did it, because this is supposed to be a developmental season for this team, right? And having Vonleh start, that just sort of gives him this aura of being a real player, and you know, probably increases his trade value instead of just having him sit on the bench. But you know, the fact that they don't ever bring him back in, that they don't really believe that he's, you know, one of the 5 best players on the team. And he has a negative 2.8 net rating despite basically playing all of his minutes with CJ and Dame. And I think especially once you get into a playoff situation, when you're getting with a team that's fighting for seeding, fighting to make the playoffs, maybe it's time to adjust that. At this point, with the organizational priorities kind of having changed, and finally, he does a nice job defensively. He can really move his feet, and I think that's something that could be very helpful for him down the road. But he is just pretty miserable offensively. I think he made his first 3-pointer, you know, like after the All-Star break at some point, and he doesn't really do much else other than get an occasional offensive rebound. So with that being the case, I think it's time to probably get him out of the starting lineup. And you know, the Wizards made a huge run at the start of the third quarter when he was in, and they took him out and brought in Davis and Myers Leonard, and the Blazers immediately surged back into the lead, with like basically a 15-point run.
I think that the Davis-Leonard combination works well. Their strengths and weaknesses are really well suited for one another. But I'm skeptical of Davis Mason Plumlee, which is kind of what you would do if you took out Vonleh, unless you wanted to go small, which I think would be really fun, and maybe give Crabbe a spot early on, and then have Aminu at the 4. But that'll
depend I think that's probably the way to go with around Plumlee, maybe. And Plumlee is such a good pick and roll guy. Maybe getting more shooting around him, I think, would really help. And also, you can say, all right, Plumlee doesn't work with Davis, he doesn't work with Leonard. But he works better than those guys work better with him than Vonleh does.
Yeah, that's true.
That at least, you know, if you're really that concerned about it. But yeah, that'll be something to watch. And my prediction is that once the Blazers are down 0-2 in the playoffs, then they'll move Vonleh to the bench and not start him anymore.
Yeah, they'll have it out
when they actually get desperate enough to like really try the best lineup. But it is a little infuriating to me that Stotts knows that that's not the best way to win games, and when they are really in a game that they're trying to win at this point, that he's not going to go with that. But you know what they've been doing has there's no impetus to change it now because this has been quote unquote working, you know, overall they've been better than expected. But I think this is some low hanging fruit for them to, you know, they're probably costing themselves a point or two a game by playing Vonleh like that against the other team's starters at the start of each quarter or for start of each half.
What if it were your choice, what would be your best five for Portland right now?
Well, I think Leonard and Davis, and then you obviously Dame and CJ, and then you got to go with kind of the hot hand at the three. You know, if you have a big guy on the wing, you know, a LeBron, a KD, a Carmelo, then it's probably Aminu, you know, Gordon Hayward, that kind of guy. Or maybe you go with Crabbe to get a little more offense out of there. And even Gerald Henderson, who was wonderful in this game, closed the game and had a game-saving block at the end. That was one of the plays of the defensive plays of the season, I thought.
That was an amazing play. Marcin
Gortat on what should have been the game-winning layup. You know, he's got to get some time, too. So I think they do have a lot of versatility to mix and match. And they have enough of these wings, both Henderson, who's a pretty strong guy, pretty explosive, hustles, and Aminu, guys who can hold up okay at the four. I think I would probably just give Vonleh's minutes to them and play small a little more often.
Yeah, and you could also give, I would like to maybe see Brian Roberts play, you know, like even if you just give him like 5 or 6 minutes, just so you can play McCollum and Lillard together a little bit more. I think that would be nice too.
Yeah, and even Harkless is
someone
who I think would be better than Vonleh and probably should get more minutes at his expense. But again, Vonleh is still kind of considered the future of this team, although the longer it goes on without him really doing anything dynamic, you kind of begin to think of him more as lower end power forward type of player. But I think he's really going to have to improve his skill level to play the four. Otherwise, he's kind of like a center who doesn't quite have enough rim protection ability and explosion. Although he does have the strength, he's a really good post-up defender one-on-one and the ability to move his feet. I mean, that's really what's intriguing about him. So I'm not ready to give up on him yet, but I think the chances of him becoming a star are growing dimmer by the day.
One other thing I wanted to talk about a little bit is that a major sequence in this game was at the beginning of the second half, Washington went on a 13-0 run, and including that stretch, Washington got to the line a couple times, which helped set their defense, but they actually had more made field goals than the Blazers had attempts, even though they had free throws. And a lot of that was Portland turning the ball over, and Portland ended up with 20 turnovers. I think they had 3 in that sequence, and their margins are tight enough against good teams that they're not going to be able to do that and survive in the near term.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. John Wall also, you know, his defense has really kind of waxed and waned this year. I mean, he still had a couple of other just ridiculous blocks in this game as the best shot-blocking point guard of all time. But also, I mean, Dame had 41 on him, and especially in the first half, I felt like he was not that engaged during that run that the Wizards has. He was really engaged. That's part of why, you know, they didn't get as many shot attempts. They also got, it wasn't during that run, but they got some real good pressure defense from Nene. That's something that he's really good at, is pressuring the other team's bigs out on the floor, denying, and then preventing them from kind of running the offense and picking out cutters backdoor. So, I mean, the Wizards had some moments of pretty good defense in this game, but overall, you know, it was just too much CJ and too much Dame in particular. Last question I had for you, Alan Anderson got ejected. There was a scrum where at first, you know, he kind of shoved Gerald Henderson, and then when Anderson was trying to go backdoor the next time down, Henderson was sort of bodying him up and forearming him, and as the foul was called, Anderson took exception to that, gave Henderson a shove, and then they basically sort of, you know, began forearming each other back and forth. Anderson ended up getting ejected. Henderson did not, I guess because Anderson's forearm made contact with Henderson's head. I thought actually that Henderson's forearm also made contact with Anderson's neck area, but the refs kind of, like, you couldn't see that as well on the angle of the replay. But what did you think? Do you think it was fair for him to get ejected and Henderson not to?
No, I think they should have gone both one way or both the other way, especially considering the contact. I'm also somebody, I'd be interested, you know, both of us are lawyers. I focus a lot on things like that, especially with head contact. I focus a lot on intent. And, you know, if I don't give a guy credit. Like, if he throws a punch and the punch misses but he wanted it to hit, I think that the current officiating system, and this was a big deal with the Horford-Dellavedova play in the Eastern Conference Finals last year, I focus a lot more on intent than where it actually lands.
your example of the really hard punch that misses reminds me of one of my favorite Simpsons lines, the Sideshow Bob. I was arrested for a crime I didn't even commit. Attempted murder. On that note, let's move on to Brooklyn and Toronto. Brooke Lopez had a wonderful game, 35 points, 7 block shots, 5 turnovers. But he was fantastic, shot 7 of 8 from mid-range also, but it wasn't just, you know, soft jumpers from him as well, because he also was 9 out of 9 from the free throw line. Really fantastic, but he was unable to ultimately push the Nets on to victory, in large part because of what happened when he was out of the game, when they gave up a pretty big run in the end of the third quarter, beginning of the fourth. But was there anything else that you actually liked from the Nets in this game other than Brooke Lopez's performance? They've actually been playing better on this really long franchise record, I think 9-game road trip that they're on right now.
I didn't see a ton from anybody else. I will also note that if Brooke Lopez had his brother's hair, that would have been one of the greatest transitions in the history of the Dunked On podcast. But since he doesn't, that's greatly disappointing. But no, I didn't really see much from Brooklyn in this outside of Lopez, who was fabulous. You know, Thad Young was all right. You know, I don't see anything that was really, you know, stood out, especially compared to the game that he had against the Warriors that we saw in person. But I'm continually impressed, like, with that the Raptors keep on trying new things. And, like, this game, they started Jason Thompson and Norman Powell. That's pretty, for a team that's second in the East, that's pretty impressive.
Maybe. I think Zach Lowe has been harping on this a little bit, that their starting lineup had really been pretty unsuccessful and that they needed to change something up, especially Luis Scola. So Scola actually played 0 minutes in this game, and they started Norman Powell and Jason Thompson. Like you said, Thompson actually looked pretty comfortable, and in a too big system playing at the four, I think he can still be relatively effective. He kept himself in great shape, was very professional in Golden State, actually hit a three in this game, had another corner three where his foot was on the line, looked very comfortable taking those shots, and it had a couple nice defensive rotations as well. He's definitely quicker, and they put him on Thad Young because I think the thought was that Scola would just be too slow for him. So we'll see whether this new starting lineup continues or not. But still, I think actually the big hero of this game to me for the Raptors was Bismack Biyombo.
Yeah, I mean, Biyombo, he's a guy who I love because his strengths are really obvious and his weaknesses are obvious too, but he's able to survive on those strengths anyway. But as you noted, that could be a problem eventually.
Yeah, it could. I noted during the game, let's talk about his strengths first, that it seemed like he forced about 8 misses at the rim in the fourth quarter. I went back and looked, it wasn't quite that many, but they were 4 of 11 in the paint, the Raptors were, in the fourth quarter, I believe, pretty much all of which Biyombo played. And drivers just had really no chance against him. He's a wonderful defensive player. He is vastly underpaid at the rim exception, really one of maybe the best defensive backup center in the league, or close to it at least. So he's going to get a nice raise, and the Raptors will probably have to use cap space to re-sign him. That'll be interesting to see whether they can retain him or not. And he's been a great part of their defensive resurgence on their second unit, which has been a big part of why they've been able to be so good and make up for the deficits that kind of inadequate starting lineup puts them in. However, I think in a playoff setting, he, other than getting on the offensive glass, he is nearly useless, or just catching a dump off right under the rim. You just cannot throw him the ball on a pick and roll unless he is right at the rim with no resistance whatsoever, or it's an alley-oop, and he's not even quite as bouncy as some of the greater Tyson Chandler type alley-oop finishers. And the Raptors don't really play with enough spacing. Now they're able to score with him on the floor in the regular season because guys like DeRozan, Kyle Lowry can just create their own shot enough and just deal with the fact that there's help defense. I mean, the Raptors, I think, have, if not the lowest, among the lowest percentage of assisted baskets in the league, but I think teams are going to really lock in and not guard him. And if he sets a pick and roll, they'll just trap and force him to throw the ball to Biyombo at the free throw line. And then he's going to really be powerless to make a decision. So that's going to be something to watch, whether they go with him or Valanciunas, who of course is a nice offensive player, but can't really do much defensively.
Yeah, it is a challenge for them. I think Valanciunas is it was a game they played a couple days ago. I thought he did really nicely, and I think it was against Houston. He had some nice stretches in that game. So yeah, you can kind of mix and match it a little bit. Something I was thinking about during this game, I don't know if you have a thought on this, is so Corey Joseph, he's been closing games sometimes with them, and I think he does a nice job with that. He's a guy who comes off the bench, and something that I think about when you have a guy who is talented, but because there's somebody in front of him, he doesn't play, is that they often play too few minutes. I think this is sometimes true with Iguodala, though the Warriors have figured that out a little bit better. So one thing I was thinking as a possibility when a team doesn't have a strong three, because of course you wouldn't want to do it then, is just throwing him out there for like the first 3 minutes of a half, then pulling him and bringing him back in just to get him a couple more minutes, because he's better than Norman Powell.
Yeah, that's true. He is. And maybe he wouldn't work quite as well at the starters. I think Powell, at least, he kind of knows that his role is just to take an open three when he gets it, and Joseph is going to record scratch on a lot of those plays. But yeah, that's actually a decent thought. When you've got a guy who's going to come in with the backups to just say, all right, we're going to start you for the first 3 minutes. But, you know, it really seems like that is just something that teams have never done, to just say, hey, you know, we're going to bring you out there for 3 minutes and then take you out immediately. You know, it's almost just insulting to the player, maybe, you know, for anyone to just play less than 6 minutes at the start of the game. Unless sometimes you'll see it in the second half when guys are just when it's really not working. And it also didn't work at the start of the first half. But yeah, I think that is something that, and we talk about these theories a lot. There is, of course, the egos to manage over the course of an 82-game regular season. And Joseph was a guy who they signed him to a real nice contract, and they wooed him and said, you're a big part of the future. And so you can't necessarily jack a guy like that around. He might want to start, but, you know, that's it's hard to say whether he'd be comfortable with that type of maneuvering of his playing time.
I'm sure you want to talk about Willie Reed, though.
Thank you for cutting me off there. I was getting to ramble.
You were.
Yeah. No, that was like a real thank you, not a sarcastic thank you. Yeah, Willie Reed, I mean, Kevin Pelton tried to trade for him in the mock trade deadline podcast. I had not seen as much of Willie, especially because he missed, I think, the first 6 weeks or so with an injury. And he played extremely well in the first half, as the Nets went on a very nice run to go up by 10 and actually built a 16-point lead ultimately in this game before the Raptors came roaring back at the end of the third quarter. And Reed was running the floor really hard. He was moving his feet defensively. He was switching. He was getting defensive rebounds. He was contesting shots in the lane. He was running the floor, making passes to guys on the fast break. Really just looked awesome. And I think a guy who could be a nice backup center option, he will be a restricted free agent. He's making the minimum this year. The Nets will be in the driver's seat to retain him, although they may have to use some of their cap space to do it. He'll have a pretty small cap hold, though. They may have to break into the room exception, though, if they want to bring him back or match. But, yeah, I thought he was good. Not quite as good in the second half, but certainly looking like a guy who's a quality find as a backup center, at least for one game. And, you know, a lot of people have been very complimentary of his performance of late as well.
And we talk about it sometimes, but I think it's underappreciated how important getting 48 good minutes from the center position is. And there are inferior players who get minutes there. Biombo's, of course, one of the best. He is not one of the examples of an inferior team, but you can also see that in Toronto is this, that when you can get that, when you can go from 30 to 32, especially because no center, you can't really ever say, oh, just strap it on and you're going to play like 48 minutes, except for Al Horford in those playoff games. And so you just have to do that. And if you can get somebody like Willie Reed or, you know, whoever, there are a couple of other guys in the league that I really like, then it really can help your rotation.
A couple other general notes in this game. The Raptors love to isolate DeMar DeRozan, especially late clock. The Nets were able to foil that, especially against the Raptors starting lineup, where they had Powell, Jason Thompson, Valanciunas, I mean, guys who are okay shooters when they have a ton of time, but not someone who's going to move to a spot and get a shot off. And so the Nets just started sending a second guy at DeRozan, even really before he got into the middle, before he got into his move, just bringing him all the way across the court. It was a very obvious double team, 20 feet from the basket on the right wing. And the Raptors repeatedly failed to be able to punish that strategy, which I thought was pretty disappointing. That's something that they're going to see a lot more of as well, I think, with DeRozan. And he loves to operate that way, hold the ball in his hands for a while. And they either are going to have to get different personnel on the floor, have those guys find a spot where they can get the ball and make a play, or have DeRozan stop running those plays. And that's no good for them because they're pretty effective at those.
And that's what the playoffs are, is figuring out teams will take what you do well and what you're comfortable doing and figure out a way to stop it. And you have to develop that counterpunch. And if they don't have it now, they have a month to figure it out.
We've seen teams that like to score the way the Raptors do be pretty efficient in the regular season. The two that come to mind are the, I think it was the 2011 Hawks. And then the 09 Blazers were teams that ran a ton of isolations, pretty slow pace. Part of why they were so good on offense was they avoided turning the ball over because they ran so many isolations. And those teams really ran into trouble in the playoffs. So we'll see whether that actually happens to this Raptors team as well. I mean, between that and the fact that they rely so much on their superior bench, which is less of an advantage as starters play more in the playoffs, I do think that this is a team that is kind of set up for being a worse playoff team than a regular season team, which I'm sure is not what Toronto fans want to hear.
And you know who the 7th seed right now is?
No, actually I don't.
The Pacers, who I think are probably the worst matchup for them.
Yeah, that's a real good point, actually. I mean, George Hill, I think, could do a nice job on Lowry. Paul George can do a great job on DeRozan. He's got the length where he's not going to fall for all of his kind of BS pump fakes. Yeah, you make a great point there. I think that they could have some big trouble scoring on Indiana, who is now in the top three in defense yet again. My sort of macro observation on the Nets is I think they actually could get back to respectability next year if they can just get a decent point guard who can actually run an okay pick and roll and shoot a three with reasonable accuracy off the ball and then get just a little more shooting. You know, they only got 12 three-point attempts up in this game. They've been among the worst in the league in three-point percentage and attempts through most of the year. And then their point guards, you know, this is a perfect example. Donald Sloan, 1 out of 6. Shane Larkin, 2 out of 5. And they also combined for 5 turnovers. So not too impressive from those guys. And I think if they can find a real point guard, you know, even someone who's an incremental upgrade along the lines of like a Jeremy Lin or someone like that who can just run a pick and roll, knows how to operate, has enough size, I think that could be a huge difference for them next year. I mean, maybe not to be a playoff team. You know, we'll see who they sign in free agency, but at least to get back to, you know, 30 wins, low 30s wins respectability, because Brooke Lopez and Thad Young are pretty darn good.
And Rondae Hollis-Jefferson, when he can play, that gives them a 3-4-5 that's competitive. And so if they can get shot creation from somewhere, and also I think they should have a better bench next year than they have this year.
Yeah, and you have to imagine they'll probably have a coaching upgrade in some fashion as well. But yeah, Rondae is the other one. I think he's behind schedule now, isn't he?
I think there was
talk he was going to come back in February, but I guess they're obviously... It's nice to see them being conservative, even though they have nothing to tank for since they don't have their pick. But... Yeah, someone joked that Brooke Lopez is well on his way to being one of the most hated players in Boston Celtics history with how well he's played this year. But don't worry, I think that the Nets are a pretty good lock to be in the top five, so you'll be all right, Celtics fans.
Yeah, Celtics fans are getting a little bit greedy when they thought they could get like a top two or top three pick, like have the top second or third most ping pong balls. Like, that was not really realistic considering, well, I mean, what hurt them is the Suns falling off a cliff because that, you know, put another team, another space between them.
Yeah, well, as long as the Suns can just play the Grizzlies every night, the Celtics might have a chance of Boston getting higher into the lottery. All right, we're beginning to approach delirium here. Anything we got to talk about before we go? What do you got to plug?
My off-season preview for the Oklahoma City Thunder, separate from the Durant piece I wrote last week, that went up today. It talks a little bit about that, and one of the topics that I really hadn't considered much before that was Steven Adams' extension can be negotiated this summer, and that is an incredibly complicated one when you consider all of the other stuff that's swirling around with this team and the insane amount of money that starting quality centers are going to get on the market this year.
Yeah, I would be surprised if they reach an extension, if only because keeping his low cap hold on the books going into 2017 when you know, maybe they could lose Durant. I think if they lose Durant, then I think they probably do try to extend him earlier. But if not, and they really could try to be a free agent player in the summer of 2017, especially if Russ were to leave and Durant were to stay, using Adams' low cap hold and having that on the books rather than the starting salary in his extension could be a boon for them. But yeah, you're right. That'll be an interesting one. And obviously also what will happen to them if Durant were to leave, what they could do to try and replace him and at least be reasonably competitive and try and convince Russ to stay, which would seem like probably wouldn't happen. But that's another consideration for their summer as well.
Yeah, I didn't write about that because I thought it'd get into too dark a place. But yeah, that is definitely something that you have to think about.
All right, well, let's get going then. Follow me on Twitter at NateDunganNBA. Support the program with an iTunes review or rating, which has been instrumental in getting some sponsors. Actually going to have hopefully some new ones coming in shortly, which has been very much helped by all of your support, whether it's an iTunes rating, whether it's our performance with the sponsors using that cap space code on Helix Sleep or SeatGeek, or whether it's simply just telling a friend about the show. You know, I see people do that on Twitter and adding me all the time. So we appreciate if you could do that as well to help us keep this little endeavor going. We will talk to you all next time. Thanks.